Welcome to the Reaction Podcast. I'm joined this week by Gabby Hinsliff, who is a columnist for The Guardian. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You've written this week on Russia and the particular threat it poses in terms of espionage and violation of borders. Can you kind of unpick what's happened with the Skripal poisoning?
I think with the Skripal poisoning, what we've seen is a challenge to the UK, to a sort of very direct confrontation that's almost testing the limits of our patience. I mean, to use a nerve agent on British soil, something that, not just any nerve agent, but something that's very rare, that's very specific in its origins, that's going to automatically lead you back to Moscow. You know, you are not hiding what you're doing. If you want to bump someone off in the middle of London, there are more discreet ways of doing so. So what you're doing is essentially letting everyone know that it was you, and then seeing what happens. You're testing the reaction. How resolute is Britain in its response? What will it do? Will its allies back it up? How far is it prepared to go to defend its interests? What sort of weaknesses or wedges can you identify between Britain and its international allies? It's almost comparable to those times when Russian fighter jets invade British airspace over the Channel or whatever, and it's essentially a testing of defences, see what happens, you know. How fast will you be intercepted and escorted out of British airspace? You're testing people's reaction all the time and using that to calculate your own strategies. And that's why it's so important that we get the political response right.
So in a sense, we should have seen it coming. So for the last few years, we've actually seen very similar actions, but they haven't necessarily happened on British soil.
No, I think, I mean, obviously there was the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko, which was a very similar test of British resolve. But I think that the other big one has been not on British soil, which is Syria. And the way in which the West recoiled from military action in 2013, essentially vacated the stage, allowed Russia to become the dominant power in the Syrian civil war, was essentially, and then the fact that, you know, there seemed to be no red lines that Russia is not able to cross in Syria with impunity now. There is no war crime so awful that we're not going to basically turn a blind eye to it. And that has been, I'm sure, an extremely interesting lesson to Moscow, in that, you know, we are so reluctant now to be drawn into any form of military conflict in the Middle East that there is essentially a power vacuum that Russia is perfectly capable of filling, and it must now be interested in where else there might be a similar kind of power vacuum. And obviously the incursion into Ukraine again was another test of Western resolve, Western willingness to defend other Eastern European allies, your test of NATO's strength, and so on and so on. And the sort of confusion that you saw within NATO immediately after that incursion was again a useful and interesting lesson, I have no doubt.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think international, if we're talking about like where international order comes from, I think there's a misconception that international order just comes through shared values, but there also has to be a robust sense of loyalty and a framework which incentivizes people to stick together, and whether that's a nation state organization or things like the EU or whatever, those things need to be properly argued for and defended. Do you think that there's a in a sense a discursive problem, we can't argue for these things, or is it more substantial? Is the problem not so much Russian aggression, but a failure of leadership in the West?
I think it's both. I think when we talk about the West, or when we talk about sort of the collective will of the democratic West or whatever, it's expressed through institutions, it's expressed through alliances and networks, so the EU, so NATO, so whatever. And we have, and the UN, we have not necessarily demonstrated great unity of purpose, to put it mildly, through those institutions in recent years. It's always going to be difficult to produce, you know, some sort of concerted view from dozens of nations with very different geopolitical interests. But I think there has been a sort of fragmenting of the world order over the last 5-10 years, intensified, I think, when Donald Trump was elected president, and this sort of sense that the old order is breaking down, that it's all to play for now, that alliances are shifting and breaking up, you know, that creates a very volatile and unpredictable climate in which to operate. And there's also the other thing is that I think probably years of military interventions which haven't gone brilliantly well in the Middle East have created a sense that the West is tired of intervening militarily, that it doesn't have public support at home for anything that inflicts casualties, and also is broke. Defence spending has been declining through the period of recession. You know, there is no great appetite for military adventures overseas anymore.
So, in a sense, where that the old order comes from is, I think it comes from 1945 and this consensus around, I think, remembering the war, and also on another level, remembering stuff like trauma, genocide, those sort of things, where you have a real movement to say there's a dignity to human life. It's not just a material thing. There are values that come from the Western inheritance that allow us to say that conflict is good sometimes and bad sometimes. But Russia never really played a full part in that story.
No, and I think our concept of a just war has been, or, you know, that concept that there are times when it's a good thing to go to war, that has been shaken by some of the military conflicts that we've been involved with in the last few years. So our sort of, and the idea, you know, if you think back only a decade ago, we were going to export Western democracy to the Middle East, and, you know, we were going to bring our tremendous values, supposedly, to other governments, and to put it mildly, that has not ended well. So I think there is a loss of moral authority and confidence on our side, and on the other side, as you say, you know, that was never really part of Russian thinking, you know. So it's all very well us having a sort of set of rules and values and norms, but if those are not shared with the Russians, then we can't be tremendously surprised when you come into conflict.
So you talk about like a loss of moral authority in the West. How then does Britain assert a particular... I mean, what I find interesting about Emmanuel Macron, for example, is that he has found a language which talks about French authority and French history, and then connects it to other things that go on in the world in the present. He uses big sweeping historical arguments to make arguments for policy change, whether that's in West Africa or in Korea or wherever, or on climate change, for example. He's quite good at doing that. But can Britain have a distinctive British voice that also connects to that inheritance of shared norms?
It slightly remains to be seen whether Macron has just a great argument or actually a great policy. But putting that aside for a minute, I think it's very hard for Britain in the phase that it's currently in, which is in the middle of Brexit, in the middle of breaking up alliances to some extent. You know, we continue to insist that we want to remain on excellent terms with our European partners, that Theresa May wants a deepened special partnership, whatever that means. But that is not, our words are going in a different direction from our actions, shall we say. And I think the idea that at that point, you know, once we are out of the EU, I mean, there are questions raised about whether our seat on, you know, whether our sort of involvement in the UN is the same as it was, you know, our seat on Permanent Security Council. I think the idea that we are in a leadership position at the moment, when our two sort of axes, we have had the position we've had partly because we had an almost unique position between the EU, between the US and the EU. You know, we translated Europe to America and vice versa. We had a special relationship with Washington, but we were also, you know, an EU partner. And the fact that we were slightly on the outside almost, or on the fringes of Europe, was in some ways a weakness and in some ways very much our strength. And I don't think we have that position anymore. The special relationship looks less special by the day, given the way the White House responded to this latest poisoning and the challenges it presents to Britain. The White House wouldn't even identify Russia as a guilty party. So not much of a special relationship anymore, and at odds with the EU. That is not a position from which to, you know, bestride the globe.
We've had sanctions, economic sanctions on Russia for a long time now. Is there a scope for a wider response? You're saying that we're in a bad leadership position at the moment, but is there a scope for a wider response that embraces, for example, political culture, which says that there are certain things, ways of doing politics, because in a sense this is another way of doing politics. Certain things are not allowed in British politics, public life, in British life in general, and that has to be the response.
I think there are, I mean, we're speaking on Wednesday and Theresa May is yet to make a common statement explaining what exactly it is she plans to do. But I think we need a range of practical responses at this point. I think it has to be, obviously there is going to be some form of economic sanction. I'd be amazed if we don't move towards something like adopting the Magnitsky rules. So, you know, we are looking at cracking down on Russian money in the City of London and so on and so on and so on. There are likely to be some diplomatic expulsions, and I suspect there are going to be some sort of gesture politics, like not sending Prince William to the World Cup or whatever it is. But I think there's a feeling that it has to go a bit further than that this time, that sort of the ritualistic gestures that are often made, you know, sanctions or, you know, expelling some oligarch or other from London, whatever, that's not quite enough. That's not quite enough of a statement of intent. It didn't stop them repeating the exercise after Litvinenko, and it doesn't seem to be enough now. There has to be some sort of concerted response that's not just the UK, that says, this is a line, you have crossed it, and you are not to cross it again. Because obviously there is, you know, there are lots of our EU partners thinking, well, this could happen in Paris, this could happen in Berlin. You know, this is not just a threat to the UK.
So with that in mind, Corbyn's response was quite weird, I thought, in the Commons. A very kind of strange, you know, Russia's done a bad thing here, but let's point fingers.
Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about Theresa May and how she's taken money from Russian oligarchs. I mean, it is embarrassing for the Conservative Party that it has accepted a lot of Russian money. It is embarrassing, there's no doubt about that. I should probably give it back. But whether that was really the time to bring it up, a situation where Theresa May is coming to the Commons saying, essentially, there has been a chemical weapons attack in an English market town and people, innocent people have been dragged into it, and, you know, this is an assault on all of us. And all that's required at that point is to say, you know, we think this is terrible, we stand by... It's not very hard to say poisoning is a bad thing, and we stand by the British government in its attempts to, you know, protect our citizens. And then if you want, you can ask some practical questions about what's going to happen, what the, you know, what's being done practically on the ground, what advice is being given to people, what we're going to do next, blah, blah, blah. But that's not really the time to have a party political pop at someone. If you really wanted to get that aired in the Commons, he could easily have got a friendly Labour backbencher to ask the question. It doesn't have to come from the leader of the opposition. And particularly, it was a missed opportunity, I think, to say to Labour voters who are unsure, to put it mildly, about Jeremy Corbyn's instincts on defence, who have questions about his willingness to use military force. You know, it was a missed opportunity to say to them, the Labour Party can be strong and resolute and is not, you know, automatically always going to side with Russia if that's a way of getting an America, and so on and so on and so on. It was just a missed opportunity to do all of that.
Does it go further than that? I mean, there is clearly a kind of romanticism of Russian power in some parts of the left. And that is also opposed to the kind of emasculation of Russia after the Cold War, and says that their involvement in foreign conflicts, you know, wasn't always bad, whether that was the Balkans or Chechnya. Is it kind of a broader thing there?
I think there's two things going on. I think there's a certain sort of almost nostalgia for the Soviet era, and as you say, you know, almost romantic attachment to Russia. I think there are several former members of the Communist Party in and around his circle, shall we say. That's part of it. But the other part of it, I think, is that there's a sort of knee-jerk, not necessarily pro-Russian, but anti-American slant to hard-left thinking on foreign policy. And therefore, you know, America bad, Russia good is the equation. It's not very sophisticated, but it is literally as simple as that, you know, and that is behind Corbyn's antipathy, I think, to NATO more generally. And this sort of assumption that America being world policeman, not that it is anymore, is inherently a risky thing, and that Russia is a sort of necessary counterbalancing power.
Well, it's also expressed in that very creepy patronage of Assad, for example, go back to the 90s, seeing Slobodan Milosevic as a kind of liberation figure, a man who garnered, who we were repeatedly told had big popular support for his policies. And the fact that they were anti-Western were the reasons why.
Yes. And again, it's starting from a point of view that America is always the bad guy, therefore, by default, you know, whoever is on the other side isn't. And I think, you know, there is a reasonable argument to be made that the right of the Labour Party went too far in the other direction, that the relationship between Tony Blair and George Bush was too unquestioning. But that's not necessarily a reason for the pendulum to swing wildly in the other direction. I think you have to bear in mind throughout these conversations, you know, the audience for things that Jeremy Corbyn says and the Labour Party says is not just voters here. It's also other nations looking at the prospect, looking at, you know, not to look at the polls for too long to realise that there is now a realistic prospect that Jeremy Corbyn could be some Prime Minister at some point. If you are sitting in Poland or Latvia or Lithuania, or, you know, and looking at the willingness of the UK to come to your defence, to participate fully in NATO, you know, that is the audience that his words are also reaching.
Both on the right and on the left in the UK for a long time, the various voices on our association with the Balkans and NATO, they're not just things that happen in British politics. These things affect legitimacy, like in these quite fractured societies. These are claims that can be used to back up policy stuff that goes on there. And it, I think, gets to the heart of a kind of frivolity on, I think, wide swathes of British politics, whether it's on the Brexiteer side or on the left. There's a kind of inability to see that Britain does matter in the world, but maybe not as much as it used to, but that still makes us responsible for things.
We forget that everyone else is listening to some extent, and I think particularly for Corbyn, that's a new thing. I mean, you forget, until last year's general election, almost nobody took the possibility of Labour winning an election seriously. It almost didn't matter, and I think, you know, that was true of, I don't think there was a sort of vast international clamour to know what Jeremy Corbyn was thinking, because, you know, it wasn't necessarily, frankly, for Washington or for Paris or Berlin to have a sort of real understanding of Jeremy Corbyn's thought processes. They kind of discounted him. And now that's no longer the case. I mean, you know, the things that Jeremy Corbyn said in the Commons on the day of the statement were picked up and, you know, repeated in the Russian press, approvingly. There's things that we say here have real repercussions. And although we don't have necessarily as much hard military power as we did, you know, we still have soft power. The things that we say matter.
So on the press angle, I live in Hoxton, and in my overground station, there was an advert for Russia's Day, which I think ran, be careful here, but it's, you know, the CIA calls us a propaganda station. As a sort of badge of honour. And I remember walking past that every day, going to my journalism training course and thinking, you know, what, this is bizarre. Why is this here? Why is this treated as proper news station?
We've had calls, obviously, for Russia Today to be shut down or blocked from the House of Commons, was one suggestion this week, you know, as if the problem is MPs listening to it. And I think, frankly, what the government has to do is let Ofcom do its job, stand back and let Ofcom do its job. If there are reasons for it to be shut down in that it has infringed broadcasting legislation here, fine. But I think the idea of a government stepping in to shut down, you know, would be the most perfect, you know, propaganda coup for Russia than you can imagine. Yeah. What I do think is bizarre is the idea that British MPs or that British journalists take part in conversations on Russia Today. I mean, it's a state. It's the mouthpiece of a state where journalists who get too close to unhelpful stories have an uncanny habit of finding themselves dead. The idea that any British journalist gives that legitimacy by going on air for Russian Today, I can't get my head around that, to be honest. I mean, what is Alex Salmond doing having a chat show on Russia Today? There should be no participation by reputable British politicians, British journalists, figures in public life on Russia Today. Let it broadcast, but don't give it what it wants, which is the fig leaf of respectability. People often say, oh, well, you know, they don't censor what you say. You can go on air and give another point of view. That's not the point. That's not what you're there for. You're not there for your point of view. You're there to give it legitimacy, to make it look like proper telly that you know, someone could watch as a legitimate alternative to the BBC. And, you know, and to sort of cover up everything else that's going on around it. And I personally wouldn't feel comfortable providing it with that level of legitimacy, and I'm surprised that other people do.
Thanks so much for coming on, Gabby.
Thank you.